You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Episode 130, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. And today's going to be a great show. I visit with Peter Suderman, who's a managing editor at Reason Magazine. He writes extensively on healthcare policy, federal budget policy, and he's just generally someone who really has a good feel for how government bureaucracies work. Specifically today, we're going to be talking about Dr. Anthony Fauci and his role in the pandemic, but also more generally to people who are in public health positions of those authorities who come up with edicts, plans, warnings, things for the public. And these are the ones who have been largely driving the policy changes and the strategy for controlling the pandemic since the start. We're going to talk about how these strategies have generally failed, how they've been counterproductive, and really how we can do better. And I think you'll have a couple laughs at the expense of our wise overlords at the FDA, CDC, and elsewhere. But first, have you ever considered a different way of practicing medicine? Whether you're burned out, need a change of pace, or looking to supplement your income, locum tenens might be the solution for you. Not sure where to start? Locumstory.com is a place where you can get real, unbiased answers to your questions. They answer basic questions like, what is locum tenens? To more complex questions about pay ranges, taxes, various specialties, and how locum tenens can work for you. Go to locumstory.com or drpodcastnetwork.com/locumstory and get the answers. Finally, if you want links to today's show, you can go to theparadox.com/130. There you can sign up for email. You can send a note to me, maybe with a show idea or something you want to see covered. And while you're traipsing about the internet, why don't you stop by your podcast player and leave a 5-star review to tell others how great the show is. If you have not yet subscribed to the show, obviously hit the subscribe button. There you can get every show, every week, and you won't miss a single one. Finally, if you're new to the show, I'd recommend you go to the archives, and you can find that at theparadox.com/blog. And there you can find a list of all the podcasts that I've done, and look for a couple of subjects and things you find interesting. In 130 episodes, we've covered a ton of different topics, both the practice of medicine, people doing disruptive entrepreneurial things in the space, and other subjects which, you know, obviously outside of COVID, things like, what is brain death? What about physician suicides? What causes it? Burnout? Financial issues, and more. But without further ado, Fauci's failure and coronavirus with Peter Suderman. Enjoy. Well, hey, I'm here with my new friend, Peter Suderman, who's a managing editor of Reason.com. He's also, well, let's be honest, you're pretty much the star of the Reason Roundtable podcast that comes out weekly.
That's very kind. I don't know if my three excellent, excellent colleagues would agree with that, but I appreciate it.
Who brings the best jokes and puns? I mean, without a doubt, that's you.
The best jokes and puns. So The actual answer to that is that I have to give you some like inside scoop here, which is that the best jokes and puns are all in the 5 minutes before and after the podcast, when everybody is just saying stuff that doesn't make it on air because it's not quite as focused, which is saying something given the occasional lack of focus on the Reason Roundtable podcast.
Yeah, I think when you rely on Matt Welch to keep you in on target, that also is going to just sort of have a little bit wayward course for your show. But you guys do great. I really enjoy it a ton, and so I appreciate what you
thank
do.
Thank you. It adds a lot of character. I mean, he brings a lot of character to the show, and he has kept me on course in many, many ways throughout my career.
Right. So, Peter, who's speaking to right now, thanks for joining the Paradox podcast. And you write on healthcare, federal budget, tech policy, pop culture. And essentially, I kind of feel like on the show, especially, you're definitely the most wonkish, the most policy focused. So I'd like to begin, and I wanted to talk to you about public health policy, basically. And obviously, we're in the midst of the COVID pandemic. I think we're exiting it. This has been my opinion for about a month now. But why don't you go through, I guess, let's talk about Fauci, who is probably the most famous person over the last year in the United States when it comes to COVID, and talk about Fauci and sort of how you think he's handled the pandemic. Because if you look at it as far as the CDC and FDA, sort of the, and maybe the CDC even more so than the FDA, but the FDA, the goal is that you actually, you know, handle pandemics, epidemics, like real infectious diseases. And so this is like the one time to shine. How do you feel he's done, and where do you think he's done well or fallen?
Well, I think there have been obvious issues with Fauci's leadership, and that they're in some ways even more apparent now than they were at the time over the course of the last year. That's not to say that he's done everything wrong. And obviously, it was an exceptionally difficult task. But a big part of what he in particular has been tasked with doing is communicating what we know, what we think we know, what we should all kind of accept, the facts on the ground about the coronavirus and how to respond to it. And Fauci has over and over again just miscommunicated basic information, and he has miscommunicated in two different ways. The first, I think, is that he has just told people things that are not quite right, that are either not right because he's wrong and has a misunderstanding, or because he has decided to tell people something that isn't quite right in an effort to change their behavior. And I think that's problematic. I also think the other way that he has failed to communicate well is that the CDC, the FDA, government agencies in general, but especially government health agencies, they're bad at communicating certainty levels. And so this is a thing that anybody who sort of has a field of knowledge that they follow, right? Especially a sort of advanced scientific field of knowledge, is that specialists within that field have ways of communicating certainty and uncertainty, right? There's confidence intervals. Yeah. There are, you know, CBO does this thing, the Congressional Budget Office, where they try to provide point estimates for everything, but then they will tell you what we're doing is providing a point estimate that is right in the middle of our certainty level. And then they will have paragraphs in their reports that say, well, you know, here's kind of the ways that we might be wrong. Our uncertainty level on this is, you know, this is all somewhat uncertain because these are economic projections, and who in the world knows what's going to happen. And the CDC and the FDA and the public health community in general, but specifically when it comes to the government apparatus, is just very bad at doing that. And they're very bad at telling people, we think we know this right now, but this might change in 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years. And so they communicate absolutely everything as a dead 100% certainty this minute, as if this is a thing that is simply as known as the sky is blue and gravity exists. And then it turns out they're wrong. And it's not even that they're wrong necessarily all the time because they are malicious, although I think there is at least in some cases some malice involved. It's that they're wrong because they have been, because they are unable to trust people to handle uncertainty. And so that's just sort of built into the character of the public health community right now. And they have really, really failed at the communications aspect of the pandemic, which, like I said, Fauci has been at the center of throughout under both President Biden and President Trump.
Yeah, and I think there's no question that humans in general have a real difficulty in assessing risk. And we've talked about it in this show a number of times. You know, what is a 1 in 20 chance something happening is, and then you have to try and assess, is it something that I worry about happening or like just tripping, or is this like, you know, falling off a cliff, right? I mean, it makes a difference what your chances of a certain result. And communicating that to everyday people, I mean, when I talk to a patient, I can tell if my example, my analogy for like, you know, what your risk is of something, if it's not hitting home. And so I may try a different one that may, you know, ring differently with someone. But obviously, if you're speaking to a, you know, camera, you can't change your message based on how reading the room. And so, I mean, I understand those difficulties that public health officials have. But I feel like maybe it's become more evident with this crisis, I guess you'll call it, is that there is a lack of, and you mentioned trust. I would almost say, I guess that's probably the best word, but it feels like it's a very patronizing sort of attitude towards the public and not trusting that they can accept the fact that things can't be known. And I don't know if that's, and I don't think it's unique to public health, but it seems like it's been especially troublesome, and it causes these weird things like Fauci saying, well, you absolutely don't need masks, right? At the beginning, that's crazy. And then a month later, it's like, well, of course you should wear masks. And then even just recently he said, well, you know, why would you not wear masks at outdoors? That keeps you safe, obviously. And then he said, well, it's self-evident that you don't ever need to wear a mask outdoors. And then those are like, I guess, almost like obvious lies, I suppose, if you really had that information one time or the other. And we even admitted that for the mask usage, it was to prevent a run of masks, right?
Yeah.
And then other times when he's like, he basically admits that he was sort of fudging the numbers for herd immunity because he thought, well, if I make it too high, people think it's impossible to reach and they'll just give up. Do you think that's a reflection of just the attitude of the agencies and sort of the job, or is it something else? Like, I mean, the guy's 80, right? We've got like a 80-year-old president, 80-year-old running this sort of pandemic. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I don't think it has all that much to do with his age, because that is just absolutely typical of public health authorities, whether they're somewhat advanced in age or whether they are really quite young. And I think, you know, it all goes back to the issue of trust. And they don't trust people. Public health authorities and public health experts tend not to trust the masses, tend not to trust ordinary people in basically any way. And so they don't trust them to kind of be able to reckon with the complications of uncertainty, which is admittedly a difficult thing to do, right? And people make bad decisions. Yeah. But they then, the whole sort of modern public health apparatus is built around not trusting people to be able to make good decisions for themselves.
Yeah.
That's the essential idea about public health, is that left to their own devices, people will make bad decisions. And so we, as public authorities, need to come in and correct them somehow or another. And whether that's by telling them something that may or may not be true, as in the case of lots and lots of diet advice, for example, from the government, from public health authorities over the past several decades, or whether that's in terms of regulating their behavior and specifically saying, hey, look, you can't do this anymore, or trying to come up with nudges that push their behavior, that push people's behavior in certain directions. And you can think of, you know, notably things like limits on soda size in New York City, which was a public health intervention, because the assumption was that without public health authorities to tell people what the appropriate size for a soda is, people would not make good decisions for themselves. And it may well be true that people are consuming an unhealthy amount of sugar through soda. But what the public health community seems to think is that, oh, this is a problem for us to solve via regulation and via via messaging that is, it doesn't matter whether it's true. It matters whether the effect on people's behavior is what we want it to be. And I think that's patronizing, like you said. I also think it's ineffective. And that's what we've seen through the pandemic, is that, in fact, people have not behaved in ways that are optimal and not shifted their behavior often because there's bad public health information out there that is, in many cases, expressing certainty about things that are maybe assumed to be known in the moment. Maybe this is, in fact, if you surveyed a certain number of college epidemiologists, you know, public health professors, whatever, they would, you know, 64% of them would agree with this. But when it comes out of them, you know, when a CDC or FDA official says this stuff, they're not saying, well, look, this is sort of where we're at right now. What they're saying is, this is capital T truth, and you must abide by it throughout your life. And so we went from not wearing masks at all, because obviously they weren't helpful, to actually, if you're at a park alone by yourself, you can't see another human being, and you're unlikely to encounter another human being, you should still be wearing a mask. And people did that. And I live in Washington, D.C., where the mask usage for people who are walking blocks away from any other human being, where they had no reasonable expectation of, certainly of coming in contact with a crowd, but really even with any other person, right? You would see them on the other end of your block at night walking their dogs, and they'd be wearing masks. And everyone was doing it because that's what the science said, except of course the science didn't actually ever say that. Instead, what we had was a situation where the public health authorities were saying that. And those are different things, but we have, I think, there's a media role in this, and there's a sort of, and there's a political role in this, where the Biden administration has basically said, well, look, you know, whenever if you go back to the beginning of the Biden administration, when he first took office, it was really interesting. His answer, whenever he was asked about the pandemic and what people should do, not what his administration was going to do, but what individuals should do, his answer was always, well, we're going to follow the science.
Yeah.
And that gave people the impression that whatever his administration's public health authorities were saying was the science, as if it is a singular thing that can be known with great certainty at any given time.
One of the biggest problems, of course, is the truth aspect. And I, you know, I, with the health, with the policy, you know, health, public health advocate, or what do you want to call them, a government official, you know, whenever pretty much your only tool is a hammer, you're going to use the nail, the regulations or the rule or the laws. That's really your only way of persuading people. Because I wonder what would have happened had the message been different from the beginning, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I think it's easy to say, well, have they not lied at the beginning? Because clearly there are a lot of lies being told, or at least once the evidence showed that things weren't true, people refused to back down on them. And it eroded what little public trust you have in those institutions. And then that's a trust you can't get back. I mean, once you lose trust with someone or an institution, it's really hard to ever get that back again. It's sort of like, you know, you have a 10 great experiences at a restaurant, and then you have just an abysmal experience, you're a lot less likely to go back, and you're a lot less likely to trust it, even though you've had generally good experience at that place. I wonder what would have happened. I mean, if they had said from the start, you know, we don't know what's best. We don't know how bad this virus is going to be. It looks like it's going to be pretty bad. We suggest you do what you can to protect yourself, which we suggest probably the best thing to do is avoid people when you can. If you're sick, don't show up for work. You know, be careful around other relatives and just be mindful. And then as more evidence came out, I just don't know how things would have played out any differently in the pandemic. And maybe by looking at all the different countries of the world, I think they probably had some sort of flavor on that sort of response. And pretty much everywhere, especially now you're seeing Asia catch up, it looks like it's about the same no matter where you are. I mean, so maybe it didn't matter.
Yeah, it turns out those noble lies aren't so noble. And in fact, they're counterproductive. And this is, you know, if I were trying to make this case to Fauci, to someone at the CDC or the FDA, I would just say, look, I get you. I get what you're trying to do. You're trying to get people to do things that that they're going to resist doing. And so your instinct is going to be to not tell them unpleasant truths and to not make things complicated for them, even though the real world is complicated. But by doing that, as you said, they are breaking the trust that you need if you are a public health authority to convince people to do things. And so it's simply counterproductive. I also think, I think it's hard to come up with a really great counterfactual about the messaging in terms of what we could and should have done. But the big thing that I think was missing is a positive message. And this is, I know this is strange, right? The COVID is terrifying. Right. COVID is terrifying. Like in a lot of ways, it killed hundreds of thousands of Americans, right? It's like, it's real and it's super deadly. And it's like, it's actually something that has taken a huge toll on American life and the rest of the world as well. But what people told us was be deeply afraid. You can't even really know how terrible this thing is going to be. You just have to like stay away from kind of everyone and not do anything. And what we could have said, and this was pretty apparent from, I think, certainly the end of April and maybe even the end of March. What public health authorities could have said was, go outside. Do everything outside. What we want from you for the next, we're going to start with 6 weeks, and then eventually we're going to realize it's going to be 3 months and then 6 months and then a year. What we're going to say is, this is not what you expected from life. This is not the ideal situation. But if you simply do everything outside, you're basically gonna be fine. And meet people outside, go to parties with friends outside, have your children play outside. Go outside and enjoy the fact that America is a beautiful country and we have great weather in a lot of places. And sometimes we don't have great weather, but there's fire and fire is wonderful. And gathering around a fire with your friends is great. Go do that. And that wasn't the message at all. In fact, in especially in sort of blue states that were like the follow the science states, a lot of mayors and a lot of governors actually closed outdoor facilities for people and closed parks and playgrounds and all this stuff and said, you have to stay inside. You have to stay inside. And it was this mean-spirited, restrictive message that wasn't even true. And if we had simply had a message that said, look, people, this is going to be hard. This will, in fact, be difficult. You are not going to be able to go hang out in your basement home theater for the next year with 10 of your closest friends. That's going to be the thing we're asking you not to do. But what we are saying is go do everything outside. And the thing is, Americans kind of figured this out on their own. And if you walk around any major city right now, everything has been moved, not everything, but many, 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 many things have been moved outside. But this was not, for the most part, with the encouragement and the sort of the positive direction of our political leaders and our public health authorities, who were, especially in the first couple of months, really quite anxious about people going outside. And you had all this media coverage of people on Florida beaches that in retrospect is just embarrassing, just incredibly embarrassing, because outside at the beach, even a beach that in a photograph looks a little bit crowded, looks like there's a bunch of people there, totally safe, not totally safe, but as safe a place as you could possibly be, except for shut in alone in a closet, with a HEPA filter, right? Like there's no, like if you're going to do stuff and people have to do stuff together, they should be doing it outside in the middle of a pandemic like this. And that message was so muddled and so confused and also so relentlessly scared and negative that I think people felt like, you know, they couldn't do what the CDC, in many cases, they couldn't do what the public health authorities were saying they should do because it sounded scared, it sounded impossible, it sounded difficult, rather than a little bit of a challenge to go do something that could be fun and could be interesting and could be healthy even.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think another aspect of the positive message you could have had, and I think still could, is, I mean, if you look at the disease course, and you look at those affected and who are most afflicted and who are dying, I mean, there's no question there's a stratification by age. Yeah. And we're obviously much more concerned when we have children dying in the streets of things than people who are in their 80s. I mean, maybe it's a morbid way of looking at things, but I think that's pretty natural. People want, you know, their children to outlive them. And so it only makes sense that that would have been something that you could have maybe not celebrated, but say, hey, this is reassurance. It's not like polio, right? It's not like something we're worrying about in the 50s where we had kids becoming paralyzed and iron lungs. I mean, this was a disease in many ways that was stratified to those who were old and sick. And that could have been a much more positive message about that and say, aren't we lucky that these are people who are afflicted? It doesn't mean that we, you know, do whatever willy-nilly, but let's at least, you know, sigh and say, well, we're kind of lucky that this pandemic just affects, you know, older people versus the youngsters. I think that would have also been very helpful, but you're totally right. Being outdoors would have been hugely helpful. And another thing about the public health and the CDC and FDA that I was upset about from the very beginning is I think when it came to the initial response from the virus, when it comes to testing, I felt like the FDA and CDC, I think they worked sort of in concert with the testing apparatus. They really just hamstrung this country in ability to figure out the extent of the virus. Now, maybe ultimately it wouldn't have mattered had you know, like, oh, it's everywhere. And then maybe, you know, there's no contact tracing available at that point anyway. But I felt like they really prevented us from getting a handle on what's going on for a long time because of the blockage of tests. Do you think that's pretty accurate?
Yeah, so I think that's exactly right. And I actually think that the messaging failure and the testing failure are related problems, because the reason that the testing issue was so great was that the CDC acts as a sort of centralized choke point for test kits for novel viruses. And so the rollout of the coronavirus test kit from around, I believe it was in the month of February and into March, was botched. And their initial test kits were wrong. They had to recall a bunch of them. They just did right. They did it wrong. And what they could have done was say, look, there's a bunch of different organizations that want to put together test kits and want to sort of test things on their own, right? And they could have had a distributed mechanism for this, right? So there were universities, there were private labs, there were all of these non-governmental organizations that wanted to try different things. And some of those organizations, I think it is fair to say, might have been a little bit off. Like, that's a possibility, like a thing that might have happened, right? They might have not sure. produced perfect kits. But what happened was, because the CDC said, we are the only ones, we are going to be the choke point, you have to pass through us to get this test kit. Because they said, we are going to decide what the test kit is and isn't, is again this issue of certainty and of confidence in what they're doing, of being the centralized provider of what the science is at any given moment when it came to this disease. Because of that, we lost 6 to 10 weeks up front in terms of testing on this virus. And yes, there are risks that are not, and maybe not even trivial, that are real and should be discussed for distributed systems, because there's a bunch of different things in play and people might not know which one is the right one or the best one. On the other hand, those systems tend to work themselves out much faster, right? We discover errors.
Yes.
That's the discovery process, is have a bunch of people try different things and then we figure out which ones work. And what the CDC says is, oh, no, we cannot have a discovery process. The discovery process is us in our offices in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., and we will make those decisions and no one else can. And so when you have public authorities acting like that, what happens is that process is radically slowed down. And that's what we saw with the rollout of the test kits. And then it was not only radically slowed down because of the centralization, it was radically slowed down because the CDC blew the initial test kits. They just made them badly and they didn't work right. And so there was just this huge choke point that failed and did not allow information to pass through it in a way that we easily could have if the CDC and the FDA had said upfront, look, this is an unusual situation. This is an emergency. What we need right now is to take an unusual approach, and we're going to let private labs and universities that are clamoring to develop test kits, that have the resources on their own already, We are going to let them go ahead on a provisional basis, and we're going to see what happens. And I think we would have been in a much better position with regards to testing if they had done that. And then the other thing that they did was they didn't allow rapid at-home testing, which, yes, is not perfect.
Yes.
It is not perfect. It is not a substitute for, like, it is not a perfect substitute for knowing whether or not you have the virus on any given day. On the other hand, mass rapid at-home testing would have been a huge benefit throughout last year prior to the release of the vaccine. And we didn't have it because the FDA decided that we couldn't have it. And that's the only reason we didn't have it. It is there. It would have been cheap. It would have been $15 a test or less.
No question. And I mean, you saw people who had basically had the testing ability with saliva weeks after we had the sequencing. And I mean, there's no question that the FDA and the CDC really just blocked that. And I think it's a great testament to a centralization versus a decentralized approach to solving problems, right? I mean, I think since we're forced with a centralized solution, when it didn't work, it caused massive problems. Yeah. And also, even when they did work, it still took a long time to even get it developed to start. And we see this in medicine all the time where we have various, you know, products that come out that are, you know, the next great whatever. And if 10 people are trying to solve that problem, it sorts out really pretty quickly which ones are good or not. I mean, it doesn't take years. It's not like you're going to get sent down the wrong road path for, you know, imaging techniques or laboratory testing. Or
people don't use stuff that doesn't work. It's actually pretty straightforward. And as soon as it's clear that something doesn't work, the majority of people will turn against it. Now, sometimes what you learn from these decentralized processes is that different things work for different people, and that there's not just one solution. And that's a good thing to learn too. And you can't learn that in a CDC led one solution only process.
Yeah, no question. And we're not talking about a process that takes years to find out, like, oh, a total knee replacement. We don't really know if it fails after 5 years or 10. I mean, this is something that you knew right away if someone, I guess they had COVID. I guess we missed that, right? And then you kind of figure out the process, what's good and bad. The other thing, I guess, actually, in looking at the states and the response to mandates and things like that, I think because we have a decentralized system in that, at least with regulation and rulemaking, you definitely see that, you know, you come to a realization that one way is not the only way, right? And you try different ways and find out, I mean, ultimately, it didn't really matter what you did, at least from as far as the regulatory standpoint. I don't think from a regulation and law standpoint, really what helps, you know, with the outcomes. The other big thing with the FDA, and I think I've heard a number of people criticize this, is not only did they mess up the testing, but then when it came to the vaccine approval rate, we got a vaccine way faster than I predicted, way faster than most people thought was even possible. And, you know, it's really a miraculous vaccine and so many technological advancements, really incredible. However, I mean, we had that ability to have that vaccine before summer started. You could have done trials a lot sooner. You could have had forced trials. Yet the FDA demanded, you know, the slowdown process. Yeah. Then they like go on, it's a weekend. We don't work on the weekends. But, you know, meanwhile, 1,000 Americans are dying every day. We're like, well, we don't work on Saturdays and Sundays, right? Like, you couldn't just convene on a week. If it was a nuclear war, they're not going to say, well, we'll come back on Monday and decide what to do, right? I mean, it's like, it seemed like a crazy sort of process. It's obviously the bureaucracy that leads to this. Why did you talk about the vaccine response to the FDA and how they could have done it better?
Yeah. The more I think about this, the more I think that this is the counterfactual that matters and that we should be talking about, and that people need to understand that the FDA probably cost thousands and maybe tens or even hundreds of thousands of Americans their lives because they delayed the rollout of the vaccine. And they did it in a bunch of ways, but I'm going to talk about just two that I think are the most obvious. And so the Pfizer vaccine was submitted for approval on, I believe it was November 20th of 2020. And it wasn't approved until December, I think it was 10th or 11th. So that's 2.5-3 weeks. Right? Not a gigantic amount of time, but but not a trivial amount of time either, especially when what happened starting right around Thanksgiving was we entered the deadliest phase of the pandemic from Thanksgiving through about the beginning of March or so. We had a huge surge in cases and deaths all over the country. And so what if the FDA had done what they did in the UK. So again, not something that's crazy and like impossible to pull off, not something that no first world country would ever try, just what they did in the UK, and had rolling review of the documents and simply had approved the vaccine the day that the application was submitted. This was a real possibility. And the FDA chose not to. They knew what they were doing and they chose not to. And they did it for two reasons, as far as I understand. One is the best reason, and I don't think it's a good one, but the best reason is they felt like if they didn't put on a show, and again, this goes back to the kind of noble lie thing, they didn't put on a show of really going through the documentation and looking at it seriously and, making sure that it was all correct, then they might increase vaccine hesitancy. Well, okay, maybe, but there's no actual evidence or research on this. That is total political judgment. They have no papers. They have no studies. There's no survey data that says that they need to do this in order to reduce vaccine hesitancy. That's just a political judgment that they have made based on their gut instinct, based on nothing. right. And the other reason they did it is because the people at the FDA and the public health community have this just like weirdly deep belief in the power of bureaucratic process, the power and importance of it. They think it really, really matters. And they are willing to wait 2 or 3 weeks on a vaccine that can save tens of thousands of American lives if you roll it out 2 or 3 weeks earlier, in order to uphold the value of in order to uphold the bureaucratic process. This is like, honestly, it's incredibly offensive. It's horrifying to think about, but they believe that because they think that if you don't go through the process, you will undermine trust in the FDA. And this is like, when you see what they're doing, what they are doing should undermine trust in the FDA. And so we could have had the vaccine. We definitely, even going through all of the trials and stuff that the FDA currently requires, we could have had the vaccine 2 or 3 weeks earlier, could have been putting shots in arms around Thanksgiving rather than around the middle of December. And we could have mitigated, not prevented, but I think we could have mitigated the spread of the virus during its deadliest period. And we could have, with some like half smart age prioritization, going to nursing homes and old people first, we could have focused on the communities, the populations that are most likely to die from COVID. And we could have saved a lot of lives, and the FDA just chose not to do that. And then the second thing they did was they didn't allow challenge trials. Now, challenge trials are, are more controversial because they require you to basically pay people to accept the risk of being directly and intentionally exposed to a potentially deadly virus. But there's a bunch of ways around this. And again, the UK is doing this now. This is not something that is way out of the zone of possibility for a Western democracy. The UK does this now with coronavirus drugs. And they started in February, not last year, like they should have, but it is being done right now. And if we had done the combination of challenge trials and rolling review, we could definitely have had a well-tested, quite safe vaccine, certainly by the middle of September. And if we had had it in September, and it had taken 3 to 4 months to sort of cover the high-risk population of quite old people and people with autoimmune diseases and stuff like
sure.
that,
yeah, yeah.
We could have maybe not completely stopped, but heavily mitigated the part of the virus, the December through February surge that killed, I think if I go back and I do the numbers in my head, something like 100,000 Americans. Many of those deaths yeah. were unnecessary, and the FDA could have prevented them, and they didn't, in the name of preserving trust in the FDA. I mean, it's incredible and it's awful.
Yeah. Well, and you could almost argue even worse is they prevented the distribution of the drug for reasons of safety, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
yeah.
right, which is the great irony, right? These people are dying left and right from this virus. And, there's no question the FDA, I've done episodes on this before, but there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people who have died because of delayed acquisition of life-saving medications for 1 to 2, 3 years for because of the phase three or phase four trials at the, by the or phase three trials by the FDA for efficacy. You know, that HIV is a good example. They're, you know, cocktails and things people are using, but
and that is where those are, Fauci made his bones, well, right? Yeah. As a public health specialist, was he came of age and it, you know, sort of in the HIV outbreak, and that was his. That's where he sort of became what he is today, in a lot of ways.
And I think it's an interesting thought experiment to imagine if we applied right to try laws, which we have in this country for certain, you know, if you have a terminal illness. But if people said, "Hey, I don't care what the risk is to me from this virus, Pfizer, you know, Johnson & Johnson, they say it's safe. I trust them, and I've seen their preliminary data and animal models or whatever. I'm willing to get this, you know, not a challenge trial, but I'm just willing to get it. Let me have it." And maybe we're talking about July. Maybe it's even, you know, June or September, August. I don't know. But you could have very quickly gained information as well that these were effective vaccines a lot sooner. And I don't know. And what do you have to risk? I mean, these are people who are willing to volunteer for it. I think the right to try would have been a reasonable argument to make for this, but the FDA insists on their efficacy trials. And it's kind of a miracle that they just said, well, we're going to let you go a little bit earlier. But I think there's immense political pressure and, you know, to actually try and control the spread of things.
Yeah, the vaccine was developed over a weekend.
Yeah.
In January. Right, in the middle of January, before virtually any American had heard of or cared about COVID-19, before anybody thought that this was, not before anybody, but before many, many, many people thought that this was going to be a serious issue for Americans. And you can't responsibly as a big, you know, multinational company start putting vaccines into arms 1 week after somebody comes up with a computer model and you're like, hey, here's the first. I mean, forget the ethical stuff, forget the advertising, forget the, like, even the test, you have a production problem. These things are, there's factories that have to be spun up, and it's a bunch of issues there. But phase three trials started at the end of July, and the phase three trials were long and expensive, as they tend to be, because they require tens of thousands of people. And you can get through phase three trial. You can do a lot of the work of phase three trials with challenge trials that can be done in a matter of weeks and with hundreds of people rather than tens of thousands. And that is something that it's not, again, this is not like some insane anarchist libertarian idea. This is a thing that is happening right now in the UK. This is a thing that was raised last year. There were folks who were talking about this, even people who had the ear of the Trump administration. So people like Alex Tabarrok, economist affiliated with George Mason University and Marginal Revolution, was talking about challenge trials last summer. And he is not somebody who policymakers have never heard of, but they just wouldn't do it. And as a result, we had to wait from the end of July until the middle of December to start vaccinating people. And I just think it's crazy and it's wrong. It's like, I mean, we're sort of we're joking about this and this, like, but when you think about the incredible loss of life that resulted because the FDA wanted to uphold their paperwork requirements.
Yeah.
It's really kind of awful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we could be where we are now 4 months ago, right? Maybe if we had controlled this a lot sooner. And we ask 18-year-olds and healthy people to do crazy things, like, you know, D-Day was insane, right? Like, your storm, your chance of survival is really low, but we're just going to send you out there. And, you know, this is obviously much safer than that sort of scenario. And so it's disheartening that that's sort of the approach we had. But one of the questions I've had with this, you know, it's kind of stepping away from COVID, which is kind of hard to do right now. But when you look at the FDA and the CDC,
but we're trying,
right? We're doing our best. But with the CDC and FDA, I'll take the FDA out of this. Is just, we'll say, keep it the CDC. their sole function is focusing on epidemics and on infectious disease, you know, something like a global pandemic, which seems totally unlikely. I mean, what's the chance of that happening? But assuming that that happened, that's what they're supposed to be focused on. Do you think the fact that they really haven't had anything to sort of work on for decades, and they call all these things that are not really epidemics, they call them epidemics, right? It's like, you know, obesity or smoking or things that are public health problems, without a doubt, but they call them epidemics, and they sort of, when actually an epidemic happened, they just were like, what? I don't know what to do. This is not something we, because we're just used to like convincing people not to do something unhealthy.
Yeah, I think they suffered from an epidemic of non-epidemics. and in fact, you know, as I just noted, Fauci and a bunch of the kind of senior leadership of the CDC.
Very senior.
Yes. But also sort of the top ranks of public health expertise. A lot of them were trained during the HIV outbreak in the 1980s. Right. And they learned lessons from that. Lessons that were not, in many cases, applicable to an aerosol-based virus.
Right, no, absolutely.
That's affected not just that affected, you know, essentially, right, like the entire population rather than subpopulations. Again, not that anyone, not to say that HIV there were doesn't affect some people, but like it was. The most affected groups were clear, you know, subpopulations.
Yes, no
right.
Question.
It's just they're just very different diseases, and generals are always fighting the last war. Public health advocates are always fighting the last disease, and I think that's what we saw here, where they just didn't know how to react to a virus that was spread primarily by being in a room and talking to people, right? Like being in a badly ventilated room and talking to people. That's how you got COVID. Was if you went to like a really great bar, and it was a small dark space, and you were close to somebody and having a conversation for an hour. That's how you were going to get COVID. You were not going to get COVID at the playground. You weren't going to get it. You know, even necessarily at the you know, at the sports stadium with the that was uncovered, right? And so they just didn't understand the communications challenge, and they also didn't understand, I think, just literally some of the science and sort of how to think about spread of a disease that functions very differently than the one they were trained on. And that's a common problem for humans. People use the thing that they know as a model. But it's the way we solve that problem. The best way to solve that problem is by not having a centralized repository of information, but instead allowing a lot of people to argue about how to address this new and novel problem. And what the CDC does is say, wait, there can be no argument. We decide. You guys don't get to decide. You're going to have your arguments, but no, we're going to tell you what is happening and how it is at any given moment. And this is the CDC's pathology, is that they cannot accept uncertainty. They can't accept that they are not going to be perfectly infallible purveyors of the science. Again, I hate that phrase because it suggests that there is only one. And in fact, the whole point of science is that there's a lot of different things happening and it sort of works itself out, but there's a bunch of sciences. And like in this house, we believe in the sciences, but we don't believe necessarily in the science. And I think the CDC just sort of, for reasons of institutional character, cannot operate that way.
Yeah, well, and I think ultimately, even if they operate that way, you have to have a check, and the check should be your elected officials, the ones who have to weigh all the things, right? If you have someone who is a singular focus on something, well, they're going to tell you the absolute way to optimize or minimize your risk for whatever it might be. But I mean, obviously the best way to control and eliminate car crashes is to get rid of cars, but someone has to make a decision, say, well, that's not.
You could require all solution. Of them to only drive 5 to 10 miles an hour. Right. But like there's huge costs to this that we've decided it's like, it's actually better to incur the costs.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult decision to make and to think about. But it's one that has to be made, and people aren't willing to make it when it comes to public health.
Well, I'm so much encouraged now about the public health industry. I think it's going to be so much better after this. I think they've learned a lot of lessons. I still watch them right now, and it drives me crazy. I had Dr. Norchasm on a couple episodes ago where we talked about immunity and how somehow people who've cleared COVID, and when you have plenty of studies showing that they're as immune as somebody who's a vaccine, and it makes no biologic sense it makes no sense that it'd be any different immunity, you know, maybe a marginally a little bit better one way or the other. Yet they're treated like it didn't happen. And so this is a more bureaucratic problem too, because I think you can't keep track of people who had it and cleared it versus you can definitely say, oh, this person got a vaccine this day, so we know they're totally safe. We don't trust anyone else. They're all lying or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I feel like we're going down the same, we keep having the same battles with the public health authorities when they're just kind of ignoring, I hate to say it, the science, right? I don't know. It's just puzzling.
Yeah. So if I want to kind of end on a little bit of a note of hope here, I will say,
please.
I think we didn't learn a lot, but we might have learned something. And the two things that I think we learned are that I think the media, and I mean this even like the very liberal left, like mainstream media, I think has learned to be at least a little bit more skeptical of the public health community's narrative. And you see this in the rise of folks like Zeynep Tufekci, who has just been excellent about like talking about how bad the public health messaging has been throughout the coronavirus and how we have told this story wrong. And she is a singular and important voice. And people are going to go back and think, wait, she was right. She was just right. Not like perfectly right, but she was just much more right than almost anyone else for 12 full months. Let's try and do that rather than the other thing. And then what is the most locked down state in the country? I think it's pretty clear that the answer is California. I think there's maybe you could find maybe New York City, maybe some of the other big blue or big blue urban localities, Chicago, where you are, maybe even, you know, the couple of other places, Washington, D.C. But the most locked down state in the country has been California, and the rules in California have been insane and crazy. They've had nothing to do with the science. And they've been wildly counterproductive. And guess what's happening is Gavin Newsom is facing a recall election almost entirely because of his bad pandemic governance. And that's not nothing. He might not lose. And the lesson might be, oh, he can survive it. And but what it means is that politicians are going to look at the experience of the governor of the biggest state in the country, the most locked down state, a blue state. California is not like a place that's like, oh man, we just love individual freedom and expect our governors to like give that to us all the time. No, California is not that at all. They are very liberal there, and they are very like, follow the science, do what the public health experts say. And California has looked at Gavin Newsom's governance during this and said, wait, this was awful. Let's never do that again. There is a meaningful, I don't want to say it's necessarily going to be successful, but a meaningful movement to push back against that. And I think that other politicians in the future are going to look at that and say, do I want to be Gavin Newsom? And that's going to at least be it's going to be there it's whispering in their ear, sitting on their shoulder. Do I want that to happen to me next time? And that might, I really hope, because I live in Washington, D.C., where things have been strange. Might make a difference.
Can't dance, right? Well, and you know what? I think you're absolutely right. And I look at I'm in West Michigan, and our governor Whitmer has been, you know, the queen of lockdown for quite a while. And with this, when we had our last surge, which, you know, of course, no other part of the country outside of Minnesota had this problem in the spring here, she did not lock things down like she did in November. Like November, it was kind of fashionable to do that. And I think you're right. I think we're obviously more of a purple state, but she had to have been looking at what happened in California and how, you know, someone maybe stripped for power. I didn't want that to happen to her in Michigan, because she did nothing, just like the opposite before. Of course, the results are exactly the same. It went away just like it did in a couple of weeks last fall, with pretty much the same results. But I think it was entirely because of that, and the fact that even her supporters and within her party, in the Democratic Party, were kind of like, yeah, our kids, we want them to go to school. We want them to play soccer or lacrosse or whatever. And so don't do that.
Yeah. So look, it's not going to be a perfect learning, right? We are not going to learn a lot of lessons that we should learn. That's for sure. But we might learn a few. And I hope so. Boy, do I hope so.
Well, and, you know, maybe the tincture of time will help too, when people look back and say, boy, that was a little kind of crazy what we did. Let's try not to do that again. And that does take a couple years to get past the, you know, the fear of the panic and the acceptance, like, yeah, you know, where you can kind of convince yourself that you thought differently during the time when you were panicking, maybe, and then that it was a little overblown. Well, Peter Suman, I appreciate your time. Managing editor from Reason Magazine, or Reason.com. Thanks so much for your expertise and for being on The Paradox.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Peter Suman for a really fun conversation. But before we finish up, don't forget to visit locumstory.com or drpodcastnetwork.com/locumstory to get real, unbiased answers to all your locum tenens questions.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.